We do yesterday, and then we see if anybody solves it, if not, I will show you the solution. So the idea was the following. We have a perfect shielder, a superconductor, and let's simplify it by two dimensions. So this is the region where the superconductor is different from zero in this region. In the hole of the superconductor, we have a source for a flux, magnetic flux. The simplest source we can think about is just in two dimensions, a circle on which charge is mounted evenly. So when the circle is rotating, it produces a magnetic flux. If it's at rest, there is just an electric field. We sense the electric field by putting in the middle an opposite charge that is equal to the total charge of the surface. So there is no electric field outside. And if the cylinder is rotating, there is a magnetic flux here. And the magnetic flux is proportional to the angular momentum of this circle, of this rotation. And we assume now that the circle is in a superposition of different angular momentum, different rotations. And now there are two possibilities. One is that we consider a different universe than ours in which there are two types of charges. One particles are of charge U1 and other particles are of completely different charge. We will not be able in this way to prove that all the charges must be multiples of each other. That would be very interesting if we could. So if the charges are different, then a flux here, which is quantized with respect to those charges, is not quantized with respect to a different charge. So we can have the superconductor, the circle here, in a superposition of different angular momentum, that each one of them corresponds to a different quantized flux with respect to the charges here. But the charge that moves outside is sensitive to it because it's a different charge. In our world, when all the charges are multiples of each other, then the only thing we can do is use the fact that the charges that move here are pairs of charges in superconductor. They move in pairs, so each one of them has a charge 2e. So both from the point of view of electrons outside is half a fraction, from the point of view of the charges in the superconductor is integer a fraction. So therefore, at least even in our...
inside the superconductor, there's a Cooper flux.
Yeah, there are 2e inside. So what for the electron is half a fraction, for them it's a whole fraction. So we can superpose from the point of view of this Cooper pairs, we can superpose coherently a flux, and two flux. And that gives a coherent superposition of two angular momentum for this thing. And they will not know about it because for them it's completely the same. So suppose we have a coherent superposition of like this, that means that we have a coherent superposition of p theta is equal to 0 and p theta is equal to h or h bar. And the superposition of these two will give us a distribution of the angle complementary to it, which is something like cosine square of theta over 2. Then we send many, many electrons outside and see the interference pattern. And eventually, from the interference pattern, we can tell whether it's this one or that one. Then after we finish the experiment, the distribution, the probability of the angle of this thing that was before cosine square of theta over 2, now it becomes that concept. So the electrons moving outside must affect the rotating source of the flux, but there is no way to do it. They can do it because when they move outside, their field cannot penetrate inside. Nothing from the outside can penetrate inside, and therefore there is no way that they can affect the source of the flux. So first of all, I want to make sure that you really understand or agree with me about the paradox before we discuss the solution. So see if you have any questions about the paradox. You have a question about it? You have a solution? Anyone has a question about the paradox or doubt about it? Okay, so if you don't have a doubt, then tell me what's the answer. I mean, something must be wrong in the way that we have deduced that the electrons outside must affect it, and there is no way they can do it. By the way, it's very interesting. The inside can affect the outside because the inside affects the outside by a vector potential. But the outside cannot penetrate inside in any way. Even if they could penetrate the potential, this is simply connected region, so the potential couldn't do anything there. So, but they can't even penetrate inside with the potential. So what's going on? We can measure the inside and we can't affect it.
Why do you say that inside doesn't affect outside?
What?
Why do you say inside doesn't affect outside?
The inside affects the outside.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
Okay.
The outside couldn't affect the inside, but the inside could affect the outside. Because the inside does affect the outside by potentials in non-simply connected region, the outside can't affect the inside because this is simply connected region. Even if they could penetrate that potential here, it would not affect it, but they can't even penetrate with potential because, in fact, you can prove that when something moves outside the perfect shielder, it can't penetrate at all inside. So that, as I told you, historically, when I first thought about it in 1962 or 3, I was very unhappy because I didn't see a solution. And I went around and asked any people that I thought could be an expert on superconductors, asked them for the solution. And I told you some. I met Feynman and asked him. I met Onsager. I met Bardeen, I met many other people, nobody knew the solution. So it was I was very unhappy for a while until I finally found it. So we want to find you to have the solution or not? Should I leave you for a few more days to worry about it?
Will you explain the momentum part again?
What?
Will you re-explain the momentum aspect?
The what?
Will you re-explain the momentum part?
The momentum part?
Yeah.
So what is the connection between momentum and the angle of the cylinder?
Oh, okay. If I have a circle with charged mounted on it, right? And I ask, what is the flux that this charge produce inside if it's rotating, right? So obviously the flux inside is proportional to the current. The rotating current is the angular velocity of that thing multiplied by the charge density, right? So therefore I can say that the flux is equal to some parameter lambda multiplied by the angular velocity of the angular momentum of that thing, because the angular momentum of that thing, if I divide it by its moment of inertia, is the angular velocity. This multiplied by the charge density will give me the flux, right? Okay, so if I now superpose two different fluxes, zero flux and one unit of fluxon, That means that I superpose with some parameter lambda over I, I superpose a state p theta equal to 0 plus another state p theta equal to 1. Say, suppose I superpose them with equal probability. This will be equal amplitude. This will be a superposition of 0 flux and 1 flux, 1 unit of flux, right? From the point of view of these fellows here, these two fluxes don't affect them because they are quantized flux, right? Quantized flux doesn't affect the charge because when the charge goes around, it collects 2 pi phase and that doesn't affect at all. Right. Quantized number of fluxons don't affect all the charges here. All the charges here have 2e, therefore, this thing produces a flux that corresponds to 2 pi phase for a Cooper pair, but for electron outside, it will produce only a phase of pi. So the electron outside will see that Cooper pairs will not be sensitive to it. Now, when I superpose two states like this, this is a state 1 plus e to the I theta, right? So I can take, this is the amplitude in position in theta representation. I can take e to the I theta over 2 outside, and I'm left inside with cosine theta over 2, right? Because it's e to the I minus I theta over 2 plus e to the I. So the probability distribution of the angle is cosine squared theta over 2. And if I project it then to either one or the other by the experiment, I change the probability distribution from cosine squared theta over 2, which is the same as cosine 2 theta, to 1, to constant. So I must change something in the distribution of the probability of this rotating cylinder if I project it, if I make a measurement, we project it to one of them. Because for any one of them, the probability of the angle is constant. And for the superposition, the probability of the angle is cosine squared theta over 2.
How are you creating the superposition?
I assume that I started with the thing initially, with the thing in a superposition, and then I reduce the temperature of that superconductor to 0, and I'm left with this superposition. Okay, the answer.
Is there an issue with conservation of angular momentum somehow?
No, it's not that. But let me tell you, it may be some indirect connection. Okay, the answer is the following. Let us look at a single Cooper pair here. Each Cooper pair is moving. Suppose I just have a single Cooper pair that moves in a circle inside the superconductor. Then I know that its energy in the theta direction is equal to p theta for the Cooper pair. This would be pi theta. Say. Let me call the angular velocity, the angular momentum of the flux source pi theta. And let's say that each Cooper pair that moves here has momentum, each one of them has the same momentum p theta, because they're all behaving like bosons, they're all in the same state. So each one of them has kinetic energy in the circular direction, which is p theta minus some lambda pi theta square over 2mr, over I for the Cooper pair. So the important thing, if I want all the Cooper pairs to be at zero velocity, to be in the ground state, they all have a momentum that is not zero, The momentum with each one of them must be must depend on the momentum, angle of the momentum of the thing that produces the flux. If the flux is zero, there will be no flux here, and it will be just P theta squared over 2, over I, 2I. But if the thing inside has a flux, then they, in order to be they, in order to be in the ground state, the angular momentum of each Hooper pair must be different. That means that I have now entanglement. For zero flux here, all the Hooper pairs have zero angular momentum. For a single flux here, all of them have different angular momentum. So I have now entanglement that the P theta, I have now an entanglement that P theta I for each pair minus lambda pi theta is equal to zero. So that means that I can only have, the only thing that I can have definite is not theta, but theta plus the sum of all the theta I with some parameter lambda pi. Only this commute with each one of these. So I'm not allowed to know theta of the cylinder itself, of the thing. I am only allowed to know the sum of this plus the sum of all the angles of the Hooper pairs, because that's the only thing that will commute with the velocity of each one of these being zero. So that means there is no chance that I can know superpose different, two different angular momentum for the cylinder because of this infinite number of entanglements. There are infinite number, huge number of charges here, and all of them are entangled with this source of the flux here. So, for example, suppose there is a point here, and suppose I have a camera inside that tries to measure that angle. Okay, I put the camera inside in this hole and tell the camera, look, you measure for me this angle to produce this coherent superposition of angular momentum. But we know that if this is a hole inside the superconductor, we know that the total flux here must remain constant because the integral of the electric field here is zero, no electric field here. There is no way to change the flux inside the hole of a superconductor. So the camera starts to try and measure the location of this. By measuring it, it changes the angular velocity of that thing, but that immediately produces a current here that will cancel the change because the total flux must remain constant. And that means that immediately that angle that I try to measure becomes completely uncertain because it gets completely correlated to the angle of the internal current though. So therefore there is no way to think about coherent superposition of fluxes inside the hole of a superconductor. Automatically it becomes completely uncertain because it gets correlated to all the positions of the charges inside the superconductor. So the idea is we can have a coherent superposition or we can measure the angle of this thing inside the superconductor is completely wrong. We try to measure it, immediately we produce a change in its velocity, that means a change in this flux, but the change in the flux in the whole thing here is zero, because you know if it would change to non-zero, it will introduce an electric field inside the superconductor. The change in the flux is equal to the integral of EDL outside. So the total flux here must be constant. So I try to measure it, I introduce an uncertain change in the velocity here, but it immediately becomes correlated to velocity change here, so that the total flux remains constant. And therefore, there is no way to measure this angle, it will become immediately uncertain. All right? Now it's quite certain. Do you have any questions about that solution?
Is the main entanglement between it and the surface current or the
To begin with, there was a time when it was the social super, with all of them. But now if I try to change it, then the minute I try to change it, this will produce exactly the opposite thing, so the rest will not know about it, because the rest know only about the total fluxing. The total fluxing remains fixed by this plus the surface. So there is no extra entanglement with the whole thing. The extra entanglement is only between this angle and all the internal angles here. But it will still make this angle completely uncertain.
So you're saying it's impossible to do a sort of disparity standard of plots inside the...
No, it's possible, on the contrary. The point is that the thing inside is a mixture, not a coherent superposition of one factor or another, but it's a mixture.
Suppose
it's a mixture with some probability of being zero flux and some probability of being one.
Right.
Then all the electrons that move outside find which one it is.
So if I try to interfere the two, if I try to interfere coherently, there is no way.
The experiment outside.
If there was an enormous superconductor around this room, it would also prevent such.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. You know, if there is an enormous superconductor surrounding us, right, then any attempt that we will try to make a coherent superposition, we start with, say, with the flux that is zero here, and now we try to measure the angle. So we immediately start to introduce a change of flux here. But if the whole thing is surrounded by a superconductor, we know that the total flux here plus everywhere else must remain zero if it was zero before. So that means that when we try to change this, we produce electromotive force at the surface of the conductor, and that immediately produces an opposite current so that the two things become entangled. And become entangled, that angle cannot be definite anymore.
There must be some time scale.
Huh?
There must be some time scale.
Yeah, the time scale is the entanglement between that angle here and some property of the electromagnetic radiation that come out. It immediately becomes uncertain because the flux here, when you change it, is going out with some information, the electromagnetic radiation, and that thing is constant. So again, the angle immediately becomes uncertain. This is quite interesting to investigate more carefully. Okay, now, after we got confused enough with one paradox, I want to show you another paradox. And that paradox led to the thing that's called now the AC effect, or Ohm-Fraser effect, which is another example of non-local quantum effect. And the way I discovered that idea and came to Aaron Kasher and told him that we have to think about it. It was the following paradox. Suppose again in two dimensions, I have something which is essentially a point that produces the flux. Instead of having a line of flux, in two dimensions I can assume there is a point here that corresponds to a flux here, which corresponds to producing outside an electric field, a vector potential, A, such that if I look in this direction, A theta is proportional to the flux here divided by R, by 2 pi R. So if I integrate A theta around, I get rid of the 2 pi R and I'm left just with the flux, okay? So I have a point here which produces this flux, and I have an electron moving here. So the electron, the Hamiltonian for the whole system is p squared p1 squared over 2m1, or p1 is the momentum of that thing, and this is in two dimensions. And for the electron I have p2 minus E over C, the vector potential produced by this one, divided by 2m of the electron. And I assume that this mass is very big, so I don't have to worry about the uncertainty position of that. I can think about this as being well defined in the center. And then this would be the Hamiltonian to describe the whole thing, and I can do an experiment, interference experiment here, and see the AB effect. But now I suddenly thought to myself, what will happen if I let this thing move? I can certainly introduce here in this thing some velocity to that thing, and it's moving now. If it's moving, I see here a vector potential which is time dependent, because the vector potential here depends not only on the coordinate of the electron, but also on the coordinate of this. So if this is moving, then effectively I see here a vector potential that is time dependent. A vector potential time dependent is corresponding to electric field. We know that the electric field is equal to minus the gradient of the potential minus the time derivative, 1 over c, the time derivative of the vector potential. So if the thing is moving, I have a time derivative of the vector potential effectively, and therefore I say that this particle, wow, electron, we have to feel a force if the thing is moving. On the other hand, we know that that's not the case, because we have in one case, one Lorentz frame, this thing is at rest, and there is only a magnetic field here. If I move relative to it, I will see this moving, and the only place where I will see electric field will be only in the region where before there was a magnetic field, because the transformation from one frame to another is that I can see electric field only where before there was a magnetic field, but not outside. So therefore, obviously, when my solenoid is moving, the electron doesn't feel any force, right? But here we see, from this Hamiltonian, if the Hamiltonian is right, if this thing is moving, I see a time-dependent time-dependent vector potential, and I see a force. So something must be wrong in this Hamiltonian. What could be wrong in this Hamiltonian? So this was the paradox that I thought about it. And then I realized that if for some reason I write, instead of this Hamiltonian, I will write an Hamiltonian which is P1 plus E over C times the same vector potential square over 2m plus P2 minus E over C times vector potential square over 2m, then I said if I would look at this, I would find very easily, and you can calculate it and test it, that in this case, when the thing is moving, the electron doesn't feel any force at all. So the question was, why should I understand why the electron has a vector potential, because this is a magnetic flux. But why should that thing see a vector potential if there is a charge? A charge doesn't produce vector. When a charge is at rest, it doesn't produce a vector potential. So what's going on? So when we looked at this thing and asked why should we have an Hamiltonian like this, we went to check what happens in the Dirac equation if we write in two dimensions Dirac equation, because you know magnetic moment comes as a natural thing in Dirac equation. So what happens in Dirac equation if we have two particles, one of them is charged and the other is not charged, but it has a magnetic moment. And we found indeed that that would be the correct Hamiltonian. And after we have seen that, we realized that if we look at the general question of what happens if you have two particles that interact only when they are moving relative to each other. In the case of Coulomb interaction, the interaction is different from zero, even if the two particles are at rest. But if I have one particle which is a magnetic moment, mu, and another particle with a charge, E, then we both of them are at rest relative to each other. Suppose you go to a frame of reference where they are at rest, then this produces magnetic field here. Magnetic field doesn't do anything to a charge which is at rest. This produces electric field here, and it doesn't do anything to the magnetic moment. So we found, we realized, therefore, that we have to find a way to write in the Lagrangian an interaction that depends on your velocities. So suppose I have now a Lagrangian, I have two particles, one half m1 v1 squared, and the other one half m2 v2 squared. And I want to write an interaction that will only depend on the relative position, but also on the relative velocity, so that if the relative velocity is zero, there is no interaction. So I write therefore here v1 minus v2 doses into a, which is a function of x1 minus x2, absolute value. So this is a general coupling that we can write between two particles if they depend, if the interaction is equal to zero, if the two velocities are the same. Obviously, this thing is invariant under Galilean transformation. I look at the limit when the velocities are small. So you see that if I go to a boost, then I change the two velocities the same way, so the difference does not is not affected. And if I make a translation, this is not affected. So therefore, this is the only way that I can write an interaction between two particles that is different from zero only if they move relative to each other, and it has to be invariant under Galilei transformation. But the minute you write this way, you see immediately that if one particle produces a vector potential on the other must produce a vector potential on this because of the symmetry. So that says immediately the interaction between magnetic moment and charge must be such that the charge produces also a vector potential on the magnetic moment, and not only the magnetic moment produces a vector potential on the charge. And that suggested that there is a dual example to the AB effect. We can think about the AB effect as being due to a line of flux. The line of flux can be thought about as a line of magnetic moment stuck to each other, and there is a charge here that moves around and feels the flux. So now we can have a dual effect where I have a line of charge and just one magnetic moment. The one magnetic moment moves around the line of charge. It will be the dual picture. Because of this description, there shouldn't be a difference between the two things according to the fact that each one sees a vector potential the way that the other is. So here, when we have a line of charge, what it produces here is an electric field. It turns out that when this magnetic moment moves an electric field that is like that, it doesn't feel any force at all, and it gets only topological effect. So this is a very interesting generalization of the AB effect, where you can actually have a topological effect on particles like neutrons, for example, that have magnetic moments. And this experiment has been done now a number of times, and also people find quite a number of interesting effects of this in a solid state. There was just recently a very interesting article that I've seen just 2 months ago of some exciting topological properties of magnetic moments moving inside the electric field. So this is quite an interesting analogy to the AB effect, where you have it on due to an electric field acting on magnetic moment and producing just a topological effect. Now, and I think the lesson is again that you can always find interesting new ideas in physics if you are able to find some interesting paradoxes. I think it was Wheeler that said Each paradox, if it's a good one, will always lead to a progress. So we say progress in paradoxes, okay? You have a question?
Yeah, so when you have electric charges and platforms that can move, why don't you also take the kinetic term for the electromagnetic radiation? Because once you move, you will need
No, 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 because once it moves at constant velocity, there is no
yeah, radiation. But this Hamiltonian doesn't say it's constant velocity.
Was it? Oh, no, the point is that if they both, if they're in both the electric and the magnetic moment are small, you can even ask in the usual AB effect. You have a fluxion here, you have electron moving. When the electron moving in a circle around it, it must radiate. And indeed, Wigner, immediately when he saw my article with Bohm, immediately ran to calculate what will be the correction due to the electromagnetic radiation, and he saw it's extremely small, because alpha is a small number. So there are corrections due to radiation, but they are negligible. They are correction of order of alpha. Luckily, otherwise we could never do any experiment with electrons because they will always radiate and tell you whether they are moving this way or that way, and then that will cancel the interference. So the radiation is small, very small correction. Any other question? Okay. Now another interesting aspect of this non-local experiment. And that's something that I discovered only quite recently, and that's a surprising effect. The surprising effect is that usually you think that you can measure the flux by AB effect only if you have a large number of electrons. You have a large number of electrons, and only then you can see the interference pattern, and from knowing where the minima and maxima is, you can find out what is the flux. It turns out that it can be done with a single electron can actually measure the flux. And that's very interesting. Imagine that I have a flux here, and the electron is moving in a circle here. There is a charge moving in a circle here. So if we look at the velocity of this, the angular velocity theta, it has n possibilities from minus infinity to plus infinity, which is equal to p theta n. P theta n, okay, let me go slowly. Theta dot is equal to p theta minus a theta squared divided by 2 mr squared, where r is the radius of this circle.
It's not the energy, this is the velocity.
What?
So it doesn't need mass out of work. There's no need for the mass, and you shouldn't square it, right hand side.
What?
No, you squared it, and that is the kinetic energy.
But so. Okay. Two in the morning for me. Theta dot indeed is equal to p theta minus e over c a theta divided by I, right? I is the moment of inertia. Okay, now I know that p theta must be equal to integer times h bar. Let me, for simplicity, now take h bar to be equal to 1, and m to be equal to 1, and r to be equal to 1. So that I know that therefore p theta is equal to integer minus the flux minus some lambda square divided by, that's it, everything. This is just this, theta dot n. So the angular velocity is an integer.
Not square.
Again, not square.
You like the square.
Yeah, it's n minus lambda. Now, if lambda is equal to 0, I know that if I wait time t, which is equal to 2 pi, in this unit, then theta will change by n times 2 pi, and therefore it will come back to itself, right? And if I choose the same time and I have a lambda which is different from from integer, then the particle will start at this point, and instead of ending up at this point, we end up at another point which is proportional to lambda, if I wait exactly this time. That means that in principle, I can take that one particle and wait that amount of time and see where did it end up. If it ends up here, there is no flux. If it ends up here, I know the flux modulo, the total number of fluxons, right? In principle. Now, of course, this point lasts only for instant because immediately there are some very large velocities, so it immediately spreads. So I have to do the experiment by taking here some spread, finite spread, and then it lasts for some time, and I can actually see what the flux is by just measuring one single particle. This is quite amazing. Now there's one correction. This is not exactly right up to a sign. And if you want to calculate the exact correct thing, you have to look at the solution, which is the sum of a n. And actually, you have to look at theta because theta is unobservable. You have to look at e to the I theta and see how this changes the function of time. And you see that when you do the calculation correctly, the t that I calculate there will be actually twice the time. After that time, the particle will go to the other side. After twice the time, it will come back here. But this is a very interesting situation. We really have now a situation that in principle we can tell just by taking a single charged particle and a flux of here, we can tell exactly after a finite time what is the flux here. This is very surprising. Question. Yes?
So on one hand I understand that if you start with a particle very well localized, you have all the speed. So you actually go around the circle many, many times. And that's how you can build the flux. But if you start with a Gaussian that would just move, you don't see it moving around the circle, so then how can you build the flux? Although every single component.
No, but during this time, the Gaussian will certainly, the Gaussian has components. So, I mean, as long as you cut it here, if you take a Gaussian spread all around, but as long as you cut it here, it has tails that have all this high velocity. And indeed, you will find that Gaussian, after this time, will be found here. Because it will still have components that it might be like that, because we have shown it.
No, but I can make those components.
No,
it's fine. Because I see really the way that it not moving around, but
all right.
Partially.
So let's now be better. Let's now check it more carefully. Okay, so. Let's write now our initial state psi at time zero is the sum of a n e to the I n theta. This is our ability of Gaussian, right? And now the question is, what is psi at time t, at any time t? Let's assume first that there is no flux, right? So this will be a sum of a n e to the I n theta times e to the minus I n squared t multiplied by some parameter here, lambda. Right? Because the energy is equal to the angular momentum square multiplied by a constant. And you see that whatever this a and r, if you write the time t such that t times n times lambda is equal to 2 pi, then this will come back to itself. Because each one of these will, each time at this time 0 is 1, and each time of this at this time is equal to 2 n pi. If n is an integer, n squared is also an integer, right? If n times 2 pi is equal to, if n times t lambda is equal to 2 pi, then n squared times t lambda is also equal to 2 pi, to multiples of 2 pi, right?
So much understand.
No, so therefore, something must be very strange about your intuition. I bet you a doubt.
I don't doubt the result, but I mean...
Now you say that that is... What you're saying is that it's surprising, but not at home.
No, I don't say
okay, so. Yeah. So we say, we start here with supposition of A and such, that initially the thing looks like a fairly nice function here, but it has to be only here, right? So these are the coefficients A and N that we make such a function initially. And now, to our surprise, we would have thought that this function which has some average velocity here, during this time we only move from here to here. After this period, there's no flux. That's it. And we look at this thing and say, no, our intuition is wrong. So we have to find, to develop new intuition about motion of the circle, which is different than motion of a straight line. I agree with you. We need better intuition. But finally, after we understand it, we see that indeed this is telling us that any function will be here after, if there is no flux, after that period of time will be exactly here. And if there is a flux, it will be shifted by a distance proportional to the module of the flux. But this is very surprising, I agree. That is true. Okay? All right, now, are there any questions about this? Okay, now I want to come back and I discuss more carefully the exchange of the modular momentum.
And let me ask a question about this. So yes. When you say this block would be not shifted with no flux, right?
Hmm?
If there's no flux, it will stay the same.
No, it will stay the same. It will immediately it will spread
no,
like
no,
well.
No, after that time.
No,
after
a very short time, it's completely spread. But if you wait just the right amount of time, it collapses.
That.
Yeah.
That's what I'm
okay.
saying.
Right.
The point is, you might not even see that block if your A sub n's are all over the place.
No, so I'm saying.
You
if
might
I,
not see the.
No,
yes,
so I'm saying, if I choose a superposition of all of them, then indeed the time, if it was a point, the time it will stay point is zero, so I can't see. But if I take a superposition like this, that cut the very high n, then it will take some sort of time. And the most spread it is, it will stay longer, okay? So there will be a possibility to see it the minute with some distortion, the minute when I do a superposition where I cut the very high frequencies, I cut them quite strongly by doing that thing. Now, and then, if I have a flux, I see that thing now lasts for a short time, and then I will find it after the right period here, rather than here, and I can see it. If I cut the very high frequency sufficiently by making it not a point, but some width, okay?
But is there an uncertainty relation then, with respect to how you cut in the higher frequency?
Of course, the uncertainty relation is telling you this thing has some minimum uncertainty angular velocity, therefore it must stay very short time before it spreads.
But so, what I mean the relation is with respect to certainty that you will have a value for flux after you measure.
No, so I'm saying if I have here a flux that changes from here to here, then I know that if I have a sufficiently small fraction of the flux that only shifts from here to here, then it will be more difficult to see. So the point is, I can see the flux, the modular flux, to a very good approximation. And if I'm willing to do an experiment with better and better cameras that can take the picture faster and faster, I can see that the individual flux with a single experiment with better and better accuracy. Never with absolute accuracy. Okay. Any other questions? I want to come back to the extent of the sudden extent of the modular momentum in the description of the AB effect, because some people ask me privately some questions and I see that it was not completely understood. So let me now go more carefully about the proof that I've given you last time. So what is the idea? The idea was the following. If I have a very small region of flux here, perpendicular to the blackboard, small region where there is magnetic field, perpendicular to the blackboard, and I say that if I have an electron that is at some initial time in a superposition of being at the left and being at the right, and it moves like this, then I say that the effect of the flux on this electron, if I look at the distribution of the momentum, then I see that the effect is to change the modulo momentum into the I, P modulo H over A, in the direction, if I call this direction X and this direction Y, then P X modulo H over A, L is the distance between the two, this is 1 and 2. The distance between wave packet 1 and wave packet 2 is L. When they move by, as long as they don't come close to it, the velocity is constant. At the end, the velocity distribution is constant again, but there is a different velocity distribution, and the change in the probability of the velocity is such that if I calculate the probability of the velocity times e to the I v over v0 times L dv, this will be will tell me how much the modulo velocity has changed. I'm talking about velocity rather than momentum because I want to talk about the Gauss invariant quantity. So that thing that is going to be changed by the interaction, the non-local interaction between the fluxon and the electron. The question is, when did this exchange take place? And that is a big surprise, because the vector potential is spread everywhere, and nevertheless, we can prove that if we take this line, and this moves like this, the exchange of the modular momentum between the solenoid and between the electron happened exactly at the time when this imaginary line crossed the solenoid. This is very surprising. And I want now to prove it more carefully, because this is really the essence of the topological effect, is that it is first of all described dynamically as a change of conserved quantity, which in this case is modulo momentum. And this exchange takes place just when the line crosses here, so it's quite instantaneous. And I want first of all to prove it so that you are sure that you understand why I claim this thing, and then we will discuss some really consequences of it. So let me make now the proof very carefully. So first of all, I say that if I discuss non-local phenomena, like non-local interaction between one system, which is a fluxon, another system, which is an electron, and they are far from each other, that I have shown that this interaction can never change the average of any moment of the momentum of any of them. It can change only the average of modulo variables, and the modulo variables must be such that its p modulo P0, where P0 is equal to H over L, and this P0 therefore cannot change if L is smaller than this distance. It can change only if L is bigger than that distance in non-local interaction. That means that we can describe non-local interaction or topological effect by exchange of these quantities, where the parameter P0 must be smaller and smaller the bigger the distance between the two. Okay? And it goes to zero if H goes to zero and L remains finite, and then it has no classical correspondence. Because classically, the thing that is exchanged will oscillate infinitely fast and you could not see. So let me now prove exactly the theorem and show you how is this surprise coming about. So here are the facts. I can first describe the thing in a particular gauge where I choose the vector potential just to be along this line of this small, if the flux is a finite region, I have to take a small region like this, and I say the vector potential is different from zero only here. And outside the vector potential is zero everywhere, and the limit when the area of this goes to zero, it is just a line. This will be a singular flux. So when I have a vector potential like this, and I have an electron that is described by a superposition of wave packets here, and wave packets here, and they move like that, then I know that the only time when the vector potential will affect the electron is when the electron goes by it, right? And it's affected by changing the phase of the electron by the integral of the vector potential. So if I look at what happened to the electron, it moves here with no change at all, compared to, no, there's no change that depends on the flux here, but there is a jump of the phase when it went past by here. So now there will be a new phase. If the phase here was, if this were with equal phase, then now this one will have a phase, this is the I phi, which is proportional to the flux, and this will still be 1. So if I calculate the average of e to the IPL, that average changed exactly at the time when the thing came by, okay? And because in this region there is no vector potential, the momentum again is like the velocity. So here the average if e to the IPL is the same as the average of the velocity, and here the average of e to the IPL is the same as the average of the velocity. So the average of the velocity must have been changed. If I calculate the probability of the velocity, the probability of the velocity must have changed just at the time when it came by here, and it must have changed in such a way that the integral of the Fourier transform of e to the iv over v0 dv, this has suddenly changed. So if I look at the probability of v as a function of time, that integral, which is the average of the multiple of v, that probability must have changed suddenly when the particle went from here to here, and that change is a truly non-local effect because the particle didn't feel any force. And nevertheless, there was a sudden change in the probability of the velocity. So people ask me, what happens if I look at a different gauge? For example, suppose I look at a gauge where I put all the vector potential here. And here comes an electron. It goes by here, by this, the line has passed here. And nothing happened to the wave function. The wave function remained exactly the same as before. It didn't get any phase because now all the vector potential is here. But what happened to the average velocity modulo? If I look at e to the i p, minus a, px Px minus Ax times L, the average of that, because this is the divided by M, this is the E of, let me do it more carefully, I have E to the I, E to the I, Px minus E over C, Ax, divided by M, and I want to multiply by L, I want to calculate this average. This is the average of the modulus velocity, which is case invariant. Now it turns out, and let me prove it to you, that if I look at the average of E to the I, Px minus E over C, Ax, times L, and I calculate that average using the integral of psi 1 star plus psi 2 star of x, and here psi 1 plus psi 2, these are the this is the wave function for the electron and its complex conjugate. So I have to look what happened, what does this operator do when I do it between psi 1 and psi 2. So I want to prove, therefore, I prove the following theorem. If I look at e to the I, px, minus any function of x, y, and z. I want to prove now a general theorem. I look at this operator and ask, what does it do to any state psi of x? Psi of x, y, and z. I want to calculate that thing. I know that if I just look at it with the I and Px, I take here h equal to 1, h bar equal to 1. If I look at this I Pxl times psi of x, y, and z, I know that this is equal to psi of x plus l, y, and z. Right? This I prove to you in general, that this is like a translation operator when I act in the position representation. So the question is now, what happens if I take the operator e to the I, px, minus some function of x, y, and z, because this is like a vector potential, times L. What does this do in the position of representation to x, to the amplitude psi of x, y, and z? And because I'm in the position of representation, I can call this just functions of x, y, and z. So ask what happens if I take e to the I, the operator px, minus the function of x, y, z, and L, these are now not operators because I work in the position representation, what does it do to a function psi of x, okay? I want to prove that this is equal to psi of x plus L, y, and z, multiplied by e to the I, the integral of f from x, y, and z from x to x plus l dx. So this thing translates the function to x plus l, but multiplied by a phase, which is the integral of this vector potential from x to x plus l.
Cannot put just
numbers
in there.
Sorry?
They are operators x, y, z in the exponential.
I have e to the I px, the operator px, minus f of x, y, and z. F, y. Okay, I'm saying that in a position representation, in the position representation, I have a vector potential A, which is a function, Ax, which is a function of x, y, and z, okay? So in the position of presentation, I look at what happens if I do e to the I px minus f of x y and z, where these are the given function times L x to psi of x, y and z. Huh? What?
Hmm? Cannot just put position of presentation. But that's why you get the integral, otherwise you would just take the number out.
Okay, suppose let me think carefully. If I have an Hamiltonian which is Px minus Ax squared, and I look at it in the position of presentation, I notice I can write this as I d dx minus a function ax. Right? No. Oh. This?
I d dx.
Hmm? What? So I mean here, I write here I d dx minus a function x, y, and z in the position of presentation, okay? I'm allowed to do that. But I mean here is I d dx. And therefore, I want to prove now that if I take e to the I minus I d dx plus any function of x, y, and z multiplied by L and act on psi of x, y, and z, I want to prove that this operation times this is equal to psi of x plus L, y and z, but multiplied by e to the integral of f from x to x plus L, f dx. Okay? I times I. I want to prove that. And if I run after I prove it, you see what will happen. If I am here, this is now my new vector potential in that gauge. The vector potential is like that. This is where the flux here. The particle moves here and here. I calculate then what happens to the average of the velocity, the average of the module of the velocity. I find that I have to translate this one from here to here, but add to it the integral of this in the middle. And that it will be, then it produces the same effect. There will be no phase difference anymore, so this time that will not make an extra phase, but this integral will give us the extra phase, okay? So let me prove it to you. Suppose I look at the operator px and ask what happens to it if I take and multiply it here by e to the I lambda of x, and here by e to the minus I lambda of x. I think I want to plus I here and minus I there. So this is unitary transformation. I take the operator p of f, px, and see what happens if I multiply by I do on this unitary transformation. So since p of x is minus I d dx, this is equal to e to the minus I lambda of x minus I d dx times e to the I lambda of x. And if I want to know what it does, then I have to multiply it by any wave function and see what this does when it applies on any wave function psi of x. So when d dx acts on this product, it takes the derivative of this plus it takes the derivative of that. So therefore this is equal, this thing is equal to e to the minus I lambda of x e to the I lambda of x times d lambda dx plus or minus I dx. Acting now on any wave function, that means that what this does is translate p of x by d lambda dx, because this is d lambda dx plus p. So therefore I know And if I have unitary transformation e to the minus I lambda of x, px, e to the I lambda of x, then this goes into px plus the lambda dx. Lambda could be a function of x, y, and z, it will be px plus the lambda dx. So now I can do the opposite transformation, and I can say therefore that e to the I lambda of x, p of x plus the lambda dx, times e to the minus I lambda of x is equal to px. So I can translate px plus the lambda dx to px by this unitary transformation, right? So therefore, I can now say that e to the I lambda of x times any function of px plus the lambda dx times e to the minus I lambda of x is equal to the same function of px.
Should it be minus in the second equation?
Hmm?
In the second equation, parenthesis, should be minus?
Px minus
e lambda dx.
Here is minus, yeah.
No, down, in parenthesis. Line down, next line. In parenthesis,
px
minus.
Px is minus, okay. Yeah. Okay, doesn't matter. Up to a sign, everything I do now today, and my mind is not completely clear. So everything I'm doing is up to sign correct. Okay, so I know that if I do unitary transformation like this, up to a sign here, I can remove the term here by doing this thing, because this is true for this operator, it's true to the square of it. You know, if I have a unitary transformation, it's u times px times u dagger is equal to px plus the lambda dx, then u times px squared times u dagger, as I stick the u dagger u inside, it will be the square of it. So it will be true for any function. Therefore I know that if I take e to the I lambda of x times e to the I px plus or minus the lambda dx times L times e to the minus I lambda of x, that this is equal to e to the I px L. Right? That's what I've proven up to the sign here. So therefore I'm saying now that if I look at e to the I lambda of x, e to the I px plus the lambda dx times A, times e to the minus I lambda of x times psi of x, y, and z. And this lambda can be a function of x, y, and z. Then this is equal to if I look at e to the I px plus the lambda dx times L times psi of x, this is equal to e up to sine minus I lambda of x times e to the I px L times e to the plus I lambda of x times psi of x. And therefore, when I apply that now e to the I px L on this thing, it translates everything by L, so I have e to the minus I lambda of x and e to the I lambda of x plus L psi of x plus L. Because when this x here, it translates both lambda and psi. So I see, therefore, since lambda the longer the x is the vector potential, then I see that e to the I px plus the vector potential or minus the vector potential ax times l times psi of x is equal to psi of x plus l. Psi of x plus l times e to the I, the integral of the vector potential from x to x plus l. This is the result that I've proven. So therefore, it is true in every gauge that if I look at a flux here and I have a particle that goes both here and here, and I ask when did the average velocity, the modulo velocity change, it changes exactly when this line passes here, and I can see every gauge that I like. If I look at the gauge where the vector potential is here, then here the momentum is already the velocity, and the phase difference tells me the change in the modulo momentum. And if I choose that gauge, for example, then the momentum is not the velocity. The velocity is the momentum minus A, and I look at e to the I, the average, the velocity times L, it takes into account the integral of A there in the middle. So I shift by L, and I take the integral of A. So in general, if I take any vector potential, and I think this, I can show that the average velocity, average, the probability of velocity changes just when this line crosses, and it changes in such a way that the average of the modulo velocity has changed just at this instant. So the probability of the velocity is a function of time, such that the average of e to the I, v over v0 dv, changes just at that instant. And that's the only effect of this non-local effect. So I can say the non-local effect is an exchange, real exchange of modulo velocity that happened just instantaneously at this time. Then, of course, you can ask questions, how comes it doesn't vary causality, and other questions that we'll discuss next time. Yes?
You're supposed to go and hang with the premier right now.
I finished it now.
Okay. I think because you don't have to be in the atrium until 11:15.
Was it?
O'Neill told us yesterday that it was starting at 11.
Well, it says here at 11:15 is when we should be in the theatre.
Also,
you can talk another 10 minutes if you want. Or you
okay, we answered. I finished what I wanted to say, but if there are questions, I'll be answering them. So, are there any questions? I summarize then. Something very surprising happened. I've shown you that we can describe any interaction by conservation law. So, if we have the exchange of modulo momentum or modulo velocity, we have something with more moves than only ellipse. And when the electron comes by here, the exchange modulo momentum or modulo velocity is the solid wave. This is the way to describe dynamically non-local interaction. There is no classical analog, because classically, if I look at the T modulo H over N, and I go with h to 0, and I think L finite, to see the non-locality, that signal is exchanged, becomes unobservable. So this is a truly quantum effect. Only quantum mechanics can have non-local exchange in this. And yet, doing something very surprising, because this exchange happened at the limit of time. This is really amazing. Why shouldn't we have that? I can discuss other conservation laws. For example, I can discuss at what time the modulo of angular velocity is changed. So when I look at the angular velocity, for example,
it might be nice to record this.
What?
It might be nice to keep the recording this.
Huh? Oh.
Still on.
Okay. If I look. If I have, for example, this particle here and here, the superposition of here and here, I want to look at the e to the I modulo because I, the module of the angular velocity, I have to translate it either on this line or on this line. If I look at this, it's IP theta. So now there are two lines, and it turns out when this is moving and this is the flux, when this line crosses the flux, there is one part of the exchange, and this part, there is another part. So when you look different, on different conservational, you find all kinds of very interesting geometry. But this is for next time, okay? Yes.
I think that one point that perhaps you should make is that the momentum is not gauge invariant.
No.
The velocity is.
Yeah, I'm talking.
Although the momentum is the one that is conserved.
No, the velocity also is conserved. The sum of the velocity is conserved. So there is exchange of modular velocity and it's a gauge invariant. That's what is exchanged, the modular velocity. If you look at the, after the whole thing passes very far away, you look at what happened, then it comes back to momentum. But while it's going to happen, it's exchange of modular velocity between the two of them. And that's gauge invariant. Any other question? Okay. See you tomorrow.